Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia to our Sunday morning meeting. And we will begin with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge, which is simply a statement of principles, which are the guiding principles for this lodge and for all of the lodges throughout the world. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, to carry out the principles of this declaration, here at the lodge, in the lodge building, we meet twice a week, on a Sunday morning and on a Wednesday evening. On Wednesday evenings, we're currently studying a Reader's Digest of the philosophy of theosophy, which we have been studying through the year from October to June. We're finishing up in the last chapter we're beginning. And that book is called The Ocean of Theosophy. It gives a broad outline of the fundamental principles. The meetings on Wednesday nights are, you know, obviously it's an open forum. It's a short summary of the part as we go through the book. And the purpose of the meeting is the talk and discussion after the summary is given to arrive at the ideas that are being elucidated in the evening. So that starts at 7:30. Goes to 8:30, and actually the doors open to the lodge at 5:15, because we have a library that's open to the public. It's a reference library. 5:15 to 7:15, there's always people, at least one person in there, a student who's able to help if you have a certain line of study that you care to start. But also, you're certainly invited to come early on Wednesday night to visit the library and just to, if nothing else, read the part and, you know, study an article associated with that part, because, you know, it gives a richer, more lively basis for the meeting. So that's Wednesdays. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we have a talk, a lecture, a panel, depending on how, you know, the subject. And it's the doors open at 10:30, and it's always a brief talk, but the purpose is to bring out the ideas, the principles, the seed ideas, and then for the rest of the hour, really talk and discussion and try to see into the ideas of these principles. So this lodge, so it's Wednesdays and Sundays. There's also, of course, a book table. If you care to do home study of theosophy, our book table, as our library, carries a straight line theosophical literature. Straight line meaning the original teachings and articles written by sincere students associated with those original teachings. You can purchase them here at cost. We don't do this to make a profit. Or pretty much everything that's at the book table is also online. So if you need the website for that, just speak to the person at the book table and we'll set you up with that as well. This lodge is sustained entirely by voluntary efforts of time and service. Nobody that you see here is being paid to do anything. Everybody is a volunteer. So it's financially sustained through contributions of time, service, and money. Everybody's welcome and appreciated to attend and contribute, but there is no expectation. We don't pass the hat. There's no monthly fees. Yet every contribution is certainly gratefully received. Now, this month, our Sunday meetings are following one line of thought: practical theosophy. What do we do with the philosophy to make it real in our lives? And next week's, so it's every Sunday in June. Now, the title for next week will be Enlightened Faith and Spiritual Knowledge. Enlightened Faith and Spiritual Knowledge. For this morning, the topic is concentrate, then meditate. And our presentation will be twofold. It'll go for perhaps 20 minutes or so, and then after the second speaker is finished, the floor will be opened for discussion and questions. We'll start off this morning with concentration. In certain ways, it's easier said than done, but in other ways, we do it because we have to, or we probably wouldn't live very long. For instance, when we were in ninth grade, we had a shop class, and the teacher of the shop class, it was wood class and metal class, and there were all sorts of band saws and punches, and we could even melt metal to pour it into a mold. And we remember that our teacher explained to us that his peers, if they've been doing it for 30 years, as he's been teaching for 30 years, by now there's not one of them who wouldn't have seriously hurt themselves at least once. He says he's grateful that he's a teacher. He has never hurt himself. And he attributes that because he has to set the example for the students. What's the example? To focus. Concentrate on what you're doing. If you don't, these machines can be ruthless, he used to say. And so as he reminded us to concentrate, so too did he remind himself every day to concentrate on being safe and do the job properly. So concentration, simply, this is no news to anybody, it's the use of our attention. But theosophically speaking, it's the use of our attention to direct it in any direction that we choose to be focused. Sometimes we use synonyms such as one-pointedness or a position firmly assumed. The point being, without any distraction of feelings or thoughts whatsoever. The goal is to focus entirely the mind on whatever the subject or object is of perception. For instance, in the United Lodge of Theosophists, we have in our declaration the end in view. The end it keeps in view is the exemplification in practice of the principles, the dissemination of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice. This is the end in view for a truer realization of the self. So we get a better idea of who we are collectively, individually. That's the reason why we're here. That's the end in view. It's not an idea for consideration. It's not, well, one of many things that we'll do when we go to the lodge. That's the purpose of the lodge, is the dissemination of the philosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles. Now, to the exclusion of all else. In the philosophy, we say that we have neither time nor inclination for side issues. Some side issues are very important to some people, and we're not discounting the value of personal issues in anybody's life, but here in the lodge, the priority of the work, which is to spread principles that lead others to get to know themselves and to live a life of universal brotherhood, that's what we do here. So we concentrate our focus, our effort, our attention toward that end in view. Now, when it comes to meditation, sometimes we sit to concentrate. The title for this evening is Concentrate, Then Meditate. So when we concentrate, sometimes it's very easy to be distracted from our time in meditation. And it's helpful to us to understand how and why and how to... If we understand more about ourselves, we can improve on our concentration in that quiet time of meditation. And it really comes down to understanding first the nature of our mind, which is, in a sense, it's twofold. We have, so to speak, there's one mind, but in a sense there's a higher mind and a lower mind. The higher mind, we turn to the acquired wisdom of our long-lived immortal soul and all the accumulated knowledge that we have illuminating in our mind. And the lower mind, on the one hand, it's the function that we use, that we have to deal with, you know, in our day-to-day everything that we do. But also sometimes it gets kind of clouded and muddy and controlled by what we want, by the stuff that's important to us personally, by our desires. So when we come to the as we pursue this idea, as we try to find out, am I in control of my desires, or are my desires in control of me? That probably plays into our ability to concentrate in preparation for meditation. Well, why is that? Well, we all have desires. That's a principle in our nature. But that principle can be used by the mind for higher or lower reasons or goals. Desire as ambition is all about what we want to have. Desire as aspiration is all about what we want to become, to be more, to grow in certain ways, to be able to serve others. Well, that lower use of desire by the lower mind is all about the outer world, the stuff I want to get, the stuff I want to control. It's connected to our senses, to living a life of sensuality, and therefore it's connected to everything about us externally that changes. When we focus on things external to our inner nature, we're focusing our mind on things that change. And our mind, we are told, actually will take the shape, that is the word, takes the shape of the object of its attention. So if our attention is focused in the outside world, what is there in the outside world that isn't changing, that isn't a distraction from the inner calm? On the other hand, if we take the time on a consistent, persistent basis to practice stepping back, it's kind of, think of like Lake Placid, our emotions, they'll calm down. Our desires will calm down. And if we gain control of our desires, they will be less of a distraction. So when we concentrate, we will, in effect, be opening our minds more to the higher nature of the human being, to the acquired wisdom of the past. When we let our desires get involved with it, when we try to meditate, here's the challenge. The very act of concentrating, if we haven't been able to reach that placid state, immediately opens the door to memories. And we think about this and we think about that, whether it's a memory of yesterday morning or when we were a kid, and it's a complete distraction. But that same process that we follow, if we do so having calmed ourselves down and created the conditions in our room, in our home, so that things are calm, we begin more to move into and open ourselves to the higher nature of what our meditation can be. So we'll stop there for a moment and pick up with meditation, and then after that talk, we'll invite discussion.
So we are going to cover the then meditate part. We often hear the question, does theosophy teach you how to meditate? Why doesn't theosophy teach you more about meditation? Is there anything that theosophy teaches about meditation? And the answer is a resounding yes and no. No, because the theosophical movement is comprehensive. It includes human beings who are adepts, who through their own personal and individual effort have perfected their physical, psychological, mental, moral, spiritual natures to the highest possible degree, and they belong to all nations and races. They are not the exclusive property of any one people. There are those who are trying to reach that point, become disciples. There are those who are not necessarily interested in doing that, but they are very much taken up with this idea of brotherhood and learning about themselves and about other cultures and people. And of course, there are those who never even heard of theosophy or picked up a theosophical book, but in their hearts and minds, they're as true and golden a theosophist as anybody who's ever heard the name, because they are sincerely, to the very fiber, they're being dedicated to the benefit of others. So it is impossible to give out a specific type of meditation, because all those different individuals in their different stages require a different discipline. And yet there's a certain common denominator about meditation, because all of them and each human being is basically a mind being, a thinker, a soul in evolution. And so considering the nature of the soul and the nature of our constitution as human beings, there are some definite teachings that can be put forth regarding this idea of meditation. And so we will present those as best we can in the time allowed, hoping they open up some doors for further inquiry in our question and answer period and also your individual study. But we might say, even before beginning to meditate, we have to rightly prepare ourselves to meditate. And as stated, the first preparation which we had is right concentration, and that means a one-pointed contemplation of the mind upon one interior object or idea to the exclusion of other things. So it's a focusing of the mind, right concentration. So this is not a subduing of the mind, making it passive and open to whatever may come in. Right concentration. Right conditions. It is suggested that we come to some fixed time of the day that we're going to do our meditation. And it could be the first thing in the morning, and we'll go why that might be a good idea. It could be the last thing we do before we go to bed, and we'll cover that as well. Or it could be both, if you are so inclined. The purpose of the fixed time is to establish a physical and mental habit. Because when you establish a physical and a mental habit, you train the physical and inner aspects of your constitution to come at a peak at the time you need it. So the athlete trains and practices for hours, for days and years, so in 10 seconds, it all comes together. The concert pianist does the same. The one who meditates tries to create a habit by focusing all their faculties at one time, creating the conditions, because this we operate according to a law of cycles, of waves, of periodicity, and you can actually train the lives of your physical and mental nature to peak at a certain time. And you want them to peak when you're trying to meditate. It's also good to have a fixed place. And that doesn't mean a fixed physical place, but also a fixed mental state or place. So the fixed place should be one where you're not likely to be distracted by your cell phone, by your family, by the telephone. In other words, where there's a certain amount of isolation from external influences. That's helpful. But if you can't do that, you should at least have a fixed mental place. And that's the importance of concentration, to be able to block out all these things that distract us so we can place our minds in isolation in consideration of anything we want to contemplate on for as long as we want to contemplate on it. Now, if we're really excited about something, we can focus on it for maybe a couple hours. But if you're trying to focus on something that you're not that excited about, it, you know, the attention span was going to be shorter. But we can train ourselves to reside in that fixed state of mind for longer periods of time. Right living is a right preparation. In other words, we have to live in a way conducive to meditation. We have to make theosophical ideas a practical potency in our everyday lives. So there's two kinds of meditation. There's the meditation we do perhaps at a certain time every day, but then there's our lifeline meditation, how we apply these ideas in our relationships with our family and friends and the way we live. So if you think that you can overcome 23 and a half hours of the day living in chaos and selfishness and disturbance and not caring about anything and indifference, and for a half hour focus and make some results, you are kidding yourself. So right living, or the right carrying out these ideas to the course of one's life, is a proper preparation for meditation. And here's one, most important, least spoken about. Right motive. Why do we meditate? Well, if you were to pick up most books, it would say to gain peace of mind, to be happy, to cure illness, get rid of illness and pain. Well, that's not it from a theosophical perspective. The right motive, it has to be done for the benefit of all of humanity, and not for oneself. Even the motive, when we get to a certain point, and we're not saying to try to bet that meditation cannot be helpful for one's personal health, but if that's where it ends, even that motive, as good as it is, will be an obstruction to higher kinds of meditation. So if you want to be able to meditate, it's good to be able to practice that from the beginning, to try to direct your meditation. The motive should be, I'm doing this for the benefit of as many people as I can imagine, all of humanity, not just for my own benefit. Now look, I am part of humanity. If I help humanity, I'm going to help myself. But my circle of influence does not end with myself, but extends to all. So now we've properly prepared to us. What's the object? What is the objective of our meditation? And this is also very important to understand, because in order to do it, we have to have a basic knowledge of the sevenfold nature of man, and it's beyond the possibility of this meeting this morning to cover that in this context. But let's just say that there are seven principles. Three of them are immortal, meaning that they are part of our incarnating nature: spirit, spiritual soul, and mind. And four of them belong to our temporary personalities, those that disintegrate at death, and we acquire a new set of these aspects with every incarnation. Body, astral body, or the design body, passions and desires, and the life principle, or an active of the aspect of the life principle, which pervades all those lower four and keeps them together. We could say then we have an individuality, an immortal individuality, and a temporary personality. So we're going to say that temporary personality is our lower nature, lower in the sense that it's temporary. It disappears at death. It's for this life only. Higher nature in the sense it's immortal. It endures. part of it is universal. There's an aspect of it in all of life, and it transcends and is the guiding influence of the lower. So we're going to call that the higher. So the object of meditation, and this is key, is to make the lower nature, that means the body, the senses, the desires, the mental activities, porous, so the spiritual nature can shine through and become the inner ruler and guide. In other words, we have to prepare the lower nature to be a useful vehicle for the higher. Now, the higher nature does not need to be developed. It's there. It's godlike in essence. We are all gods in essence in that immortal nature. Our higher universal principles, spirit, spiritual soul, are inherently peaceful, blissful, unconcerned with earthly matters, and full of absolute knowledge. The problem is we can't get that through. We've created an instrument which does not respond to it. Imagine a genius trying to play on a broken violin. It can't be done. So the higher nature participates in the divine state of being. It is that very, very being by nature. So here's key. Keep this in mind when you're reading about meditation and theosophy and from the non-theosophical sources. Very often in common thought, meditation says we are trying to unite ourselves with something higher. We are already that higher. What we are trying to do is bring it through. Now, obviously, if you bring it through, you're going to become aware of it. So we might say, the sun is shining. We don't have to make the sun any brighter. We have to do is open the doors, the windows, bring down the shades so that sunlight can come in. Okay, that's what meditation's all about. Cleaning up the instrument so that the higher can come through. And that is work. Meditation is an active discipline. There's nothing passive about it. It's easy to talk about. It's hard to do. It's a practice that's sustained through years and, in fact, lifetimes. That's why we say you cannot give one method of meditation to all. So the first aspect of the discipline of meditation is self-examination. Now, if you want to become expert in anything, you don't start by diving out of the plane or getting on the battlefield or going to the Olympic trials. No, you have to examine yourselves. You have to understand yourself first. So when you enter this process of meditation, what we're doing is we're first examining the lower nature, learning about it in the light of the higher. So we're going to do it at the beginning and at the end of the day, beginning of the day because it sets the tone for the waking state, end of the day because it sets the tone for the dreaming and deep sleep state. That's basically why we do it. We're going from one country to another. We're coming back home. What do? You prepare. You pack for the next stage. And that's what meditation does. It prepares us for the day to come or for the night to come. That's why those times are suggested. So the first thing we do as we meditate is we hold some image of the higher in the mind, or we might read from a devotional book, or we may hold the fact of the ideal and the masters. So we might say to ourselves, what would Buddha do in this situation? What would Jesus do in this situation? What would Krishna do in this situation? What would a Mahatma do in this situation? What would HPB or Judge? In other words, we hold our mind on the highest ideal we can imagine, and then we're going to examine ourselves in the light of that idea. So we're going to look at the details of the events of our lives as best we can from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed. What does that do? It trains the memory. It trains the awareness. And guess what? When you do that in a certain time every day, you become more focused, you become more aware while you're living that day, and you begin to catch yourself. Before, you did things automatically, instinctively, without thinking. Now you're training yourself to think before you act, before I say this to this person, how might my ideal say or react to it? And so we're looking for the chain of cause and effect. What was the chain of, why did we do certain things? What was said? How did we act? And most important here, we're not just looking for the events. We're not just looking for what we did. We're looking for the moral and ethical factors. In other words, looking at the motive, the reasons, the desires behind what we did and how we reacted to things. So now, through this self-study, now we can begin the self-discipline. And basically, we have to purify the body. We have to look at the grosser and interests and passions and desires of the body and make them subservient to the aspirations of the higher nature. We have to examine what we sense, what we allow ourselves to see, touch, taste, and feel, the activities we do during the day, the words we speak with our mouth during the day. Are they in line with our higher? And then we even have to, and this is for a more advanced state, once we get rid of the personal desires, we even need to get rid of the desires of the individual soul. Because when you think about, ultimately, this universe does not exist for the benefit of any one individual soul. It exists for the benefit of soul in its all-inclusive aspect. What is the good of soul, that intelligent principle in all of life? What is good for the benefit of all degrees of consciousness and intelligence? So that is an even higher step. And we're not going to get from unselfishness to that kind of selfless consideration overnight. That's a graduate level material. That's world class Olympic stuff. That's not for us beginners. But at least we know where we can help, and we can begin to work that way. Because if one person can do it, and there have been those, then it is the potential with every human being to do it. So what are the results of meditation? How do we know that we've arrived? And there are many results. We're not going to go into them now because we're going to close up with this thought. But when you hear something that sounds reasonable, your mind says, can grasp it. It says, aha, that idea sounds logical to me. When you see something that is beautiful with your senses, or hear a beautiful piece of music, your physical senses allow you to say, aha, that's beautiful, I love that. But how many of us can listen to something and say, I know that's true? That's real. It's not just beautiful, it's not just reasonable, but that's truth. That's what meditation brings. The right kind of meditation, just like the senses help us grasp beauty and the mind helps us grasp reason, meditation allows our spiritual faculties to awaken. And whenever we hear something or see something or experience something, we know intuitively its truth, its value, its inner essence. And because we know that, we can act accordingly, according to that. That's, and all the teachers drowned through the ages have said that is the highest state of our being. That is the highest gift a human being can offer another, to give them truth and help them recognize it. So with that, we're just going to turn the meeting over to your own questions on either concentration or meditation.
Yes, in the back.
So, in order to meditate, then, one has to master concentration. It, from what we're understanding from the two talks. So, what if one has an immense difficulty with concentration? So, it could be years, maybe even a lifetime, before somebody is able to meditate, because it's like a hamster in your head.
So So the question is, do we have to become masters of concentration before we benefit from attempting to meditate? The answer has to be no, that one actually feeds the other. The steps that we take in the direction of concentration is the steps that we're taking in the direction of controlling our desires and excluding and focusing. There's a difference between focusing the concentration and meditating, you know, and we can't expect to be one-pointed and know. It is said a Mahatma can look at an object and know everything about that object, the history of the object, because he's one-pointed. He can know everything about that object. We can't expect to do that. But that's not a reason to not take the steps from where we are and get going with it. And the greater successes that we have with the process of concentration, the greater steps we'll have with the process of meditation.
Well, you know, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, even a little of this practice protecteth one from great risk. So the premise of the question, one does not have to master concentration before they can begin to meditate, but one should at least attempt and develop the skill of concentration before they try to meditate. Our co-chair gave a story from high school experience, so we're going to take that opportunity to just say we know of one young person who, when they went to high school, they had to pass every course in order to graduate, and that included physical education. And the particular head of physical education said that every student had to climb the rope to the top of the 20-foot ceiling or do 10 push-ups or sit-ups or whatever it was, and this particular individual couldn't do it. They happened to be an A student in every other academic course, but they couldn't do that. And so the justification was for the discipline was, well, look, you can know all these things, but if you can't pull yourself up, I mean, this could be a matter of life and death. Suppose you're hanging off the edge of a cliff and you don't have the strength to pull yourself up. You know, what good is it? So that individual had to do what they had to do to learn to develop in a way they couldn't, and did graduate. So the point is, we all come to these things with different strengths. Some of us are better at concentration than others. Some of us are better at meditation. Some of us are better at intellect. Some of us are better in our feeling nature. But all of these have to be developed in this school of life, because in terms of our spiritual development, it is a matter of success in spiritual life or failure to meet that. And of course, unlike the high school experience, reincarnation gives us many opportunities to pass that. Yes, in the back.
We heard the story of Christopher Columbus. When he started out, he didn't know where, he knew where he wanted to go, but he didn't know how to get there. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back home, they put him in court. So, should we be looking directly for these results, or should we fight, meditate, and should we fight? What is it we have to fight?
What is it we have to fight? Well, the Buddha taught that the conqueror of self is greater than the conqueror of nations. So what we have to fight, if that is the right word, we prefer the word train and discipline, but what we have to fight is the tendency in our nature, our lower nature, to serve its own purposes. The senses and the desires, especially the fact the way they influence the mind, to lead us, as the Bible says, into temptation, to self-gratify, to live for for enjoyment and pleasure at the expense of others, at the exclusion of others. That only is not only potentially destructive to ourselves, but also to others. So, oh yes, there are many good causes in the world we can fight for, but first our duty is to ourselves and to fight that in ourselves before we throw stones at someone else.
The act of concentration is the use of will. It's the use of willpower to direct the attention. Now, in the previous discussion where we said, well, should we first master concentration or do we have to do that before we meditate? Well, when we focus our concentration, the more we can focus our concentration, it's directly related to our desires. So, or in other words, the more desires that we have, plural, the less we can focus our concentration on the object of our meditation because of all these distractions. Yet, on the other hand, the more we focus our concentration so that we can meditate and get to a state of meditation, the more we meditate, the more we see the value or the lack of value in the things around us. And the more we meditate, we find ourselves reconstructing what we think is important. We find ourselves desiring less of this and more of that. And so the fewer of those lower desires that we have, that actually aids in our ability to concentrate. So they feed on each other if the more we practice it.
And earlier during one of the talks, the idea of the prelude to concentration and meditation is the entire way of lifestyle that we've lived for the day. So that if we begin to make a concerted effort to be habitual, to have a routine to life, to be punctual, all of those tasks that we have to do are done in an orderly, one-pointed way. That lack of multitasking, all of that helps to produce the concentration needed right before meditation.
Yeah.
It's interesting at work. We have a job where if one were to allow oneself to, quote, multitask, you could multitask 9 hours a day. And we've read that actually multitasking is not multitasking. You can't multitask. It's called task switching. And it's the most stressful thing that you can do. And we just commonly say to people, I don't multitask. Leave it there. I'll get to it. And it's that way we can do everything completely. And we would say that it works in the rest of life as well if it works with paperwork, right?
The idea of concentration isn't that foreign to us. I mean, it's not. The average person has to concentrate in order to carry out just their daily tasks. The housewife who was making dinner, chopping the potatoes, she is concentrating. That's why she's not leaving fingers on the board, because she's thinking of what she's doing. The husband who is repairing some broken object in the house knows to bring the right tools. That calls for concentration, how to use them. So it's not like concentration is some far off mystical land that we have to go to and overcome. It is just using what we already use and being more specific about how we use it.
Thank you. Yes?
Getting back to what you were saying before, when you was talking about the immortal soul, what does the soul consist of? Does it consist of everything that we do, whether it's good or bad in a lifetime, consolidated into one? Or it's where our whole being is? And does our soul live somewhere eternally? Where does our soul rest at?
Yes.
It says it's immortal.
Yes. Well, the word soul is such a vast usage that we can only properly discuss it in theosophy if we qualify it by certain aspects of its function. So we could say that in general, the human being, as Paul said, is spirit, soul, and body, St. Paul. And we know what the body is. And we have some idea of what spirit is if we see it as that all-pervading, universal, impelling principle that behind all things. Well, then soul is everything in between. It includes the entire inner world that is real to us. It's just not objective. It includes, for human beings, their inner sensations, their memories, their thoughts, their feelings of higher and lower degree, their powers to think, not just what they think, but their powers to think. So soul is the receptor, the perceiver of those experiences. It's also the retainer of those experiences. And it's also the one who acts on those experiences. So soul, from a human being's point of view, we are individual souls because each of us is independently capable of how we are going to self-consciously think and feel and act and respond and perceive a situation. So for us as individual souls, we could all listen to the same speech or the same music and hear it differently or take something differently from it and do something differently with it. We could all be exposed to the same meal and react differently to it as to what we were going to take. In the lower kingdoms, yes, there is sensitivity, there is action, there is receptivity, there's memory, but there's not that individual choice. In those, the beings are defined as how they collectively and instinctively respond to a situation. So squirrels and panthers and lions and tigers, they all, you can study them as how they react as a group, as a herd. They don't have that individual. So for the human being, we speak of our individual soul. And that is what goes from life to life. It retains the impressions, the memories of all those lives, but it is also the one that perceives through all those lives and the one who has to act upon all those conditions.
And we would add to that, and part of the question was, is it all of the good and the bad that we experience? And, well, if we consider our soul as the entire metaphysical being between pure spirit and physical body, well, then, yeah, it's all there. But if we consider the soul just in its immortal aspect, then all of the negative, the lower, the less, that does not carry on with the immortal soul. The immortal soul is the summation, the accumulated wisdom, and the assimilated highest aspirations and ideas that we experience, that are worthy of assimilation, that are worthy of bringing into heaven. Now, the rest, that's not to say that we're not responsible for the rest, because through reincarnation, we'll be back to experience the rest and transmute that as well. But that is not part of the immortal, we could just say, yet.
And also, when you were saying that the negative does not carry on with the wisdom that we have, so in other words, so it's purified in some way or another to be perfected to the wisdom and to the higher self, and the lower self is like residual.
Is a residual that will eventually be transmuted fully into the higher self.
Okay.
Eventually it will be.
Just to qualify that, it's residual, but it's not waste.
Right.
Okay.
It's a necessary instrument. We don't want to put a negative view on the personality. We need it. None of us could function here without our personal faculties. The thing is, they need to be disciplined and trained and purified of their dross. Okay, so difference here. We also wanted to say if the purpose of life is to learn and reincarnation gives us opportunities as immortal spiritual beings to assimilate all that knowledge, and let's say it takes so long to do that, what do you think happens when you concentrate and focus and you begin to discipline and meditate and assimilate all those lessons here and now as much as you can in one life? You shorten the time it takes to reach that perfected state of wisdom possible. And having reached that sooner, now you are in a position, if you so choose, to come back and help others, or if you so choose, then you can go into that state of what's called in the East nirvana. But in other words, the lessons have to be learned before you get to that state. It's either going to take you a lifelong life cycle, or you can shorten it, make it quicker, if you want to be a true servant of humanity and come back with all that knowledge and ability to help others. That's what the great masters and adepts and sages have done. They are here. They take up that sacrifice, not because they need to, but because they feel themselves at one with their younger brothers and need to point out the way.
Yes.
You mentioned the Gita. In the Gita, it states that we are compelled to act. And we find that our actions, you know, either clear a path for us or create a spider web for us. But also, in the Gita, it states how to live your life. Now, is there a meditation other than sitting quietly? Is there a meditation that extends throughout your life? That, you know, that how you live, you know, basically?
Well, there's actually both a concentration and a meditation that lasts throughout the life. We'll start with the concentration side of it. So concentrating is not just an event that we sit on the daily basis, or the concentration in whatever we're doing, placing our attention on whatever it is that we're doing. But as we concentrate and meditate both, it actually has an effect not just by strengthening our use of will to control the desires, it also has an effect on edifying that astral body within us, which during the kindergarten stage is there, and it has its purpose as an electromagnetic field around which our physical organs grow and form. But also, as we meditate and concentrate, the effect on the astral body is that that astral body can come to tease itself from the physical and actually form more definitely organs within, so that it can operate in and of its own self, free from or devoid of even the physical body. So concentration through the lifetime has, you know, if we live a, so to speak, a concentrated life, the effect of that will be on the astral body as well as the mind. And this is something that we're told that adepts will do, so that at the end of a given life, they don't kind of die and go into these after-death states. They just put the physical body down, maintain fully their consciousness, their awareness, and carry on with the work that they're doing. So that's the concentration part of it, the concentration of a lifetime.
And just to follow up on that, many have realized that as they try to carry out this spiritual practice, that a family member or a friend or even a co-worker or a boss may come up and say, well, you know, you've changed your whole attitude, the way you approach things. You know, there's this project at work that needs to get done, or this group we need to, you seem to be the person that can handle, you seem to really have a good grasp. In other words, these things carry over into other areas of our life beside the one we're working on, and we become better co-workers, we get better employees, better teachers, better students, not just better souls in the process of of evolution. It all carries through. We did want to say the life's meditation, or how do we do this? It is said in the declaration, the purpose of the lodge here is the exemplification in the practice of these principles and the promulgation of these principles. So the lodge work does not begin and end with the hour in a few minutes. It's what we learn here that we carry out into our everyday lives. To what extent, as we influence ourselves and as we react to others, are we putting these principles into practice? What extent are we thinking about them, talking about them in ways that we can understand and other people can understand, but not necessarily proselytize. I'm not trying to proselytize, but help share the ideas with others. Okay, that's a life's meditation. That's using the mind in a non-distracted way to raise the lower aspects of life, not just our own, but the entire life around us, to a higher degree based on these high ideals. That's what meditation is, to elevate the lower, to make this world, this community, this city, a better instrument so that the higher aspects of all our fellow citizens can come through on this plane, not just ourselves.
Yes, in the back.
There must be some sort of idea, because when we were little boys, we all wanted to be lawyers, doctors, and so forth. But our parents must know something, because we come pretty close to that. Are there some ideas, fundamental ideas, that we can use to approach this idea of concentration, meditation, to produce the results?
Well, we'll start with it. You know, if we accept, you know, our ideas of what God is has an effect on how we live our life. So theosophically speaking, we have to get away from the idea that it's a willful personal being that decides who's good, who's bad, what he likes, what he doesn't like, but rather recognize it as the divine principle in all of nature, which is available in its full creative power and is the source of the very power to be. We can't define it more than that. But therefore, we have to realize whatever's going on in our life, it's up to us. It's the God within each individual, which is really the God of all of us. But in this conditioned experience, in this incarnated experience, it's the individualized aspect of it. Well, theosophically, we're told, well, if there's not a God that's going to dictate to us what to do, how do we know what's right from wrong? Well, sit back and observe nature, and we see what? Commonly, universal cycles. It's the law of periodicity, which if we recognize and work with, we come to see the very processes of nature expressing themselves, which is, in all the different processes, ultimately, the evolution of soul. Now, the evolution of soul means different things in different kingdoms. To the human kingdom, the evolution of soul means ultimately a full initiation into complete wisdom, the most perfected absolute wisdom available at any point in period in evolution. The evolution of soul for the lower kingdoms is the next step in the evolution, the progress of the intelligence, which informs any of the lower kingdoms. So this all occurs through the processes of cycles, of cyclic law. If we bear that in mind, then the very cycle that we set on a daily basis to focus our mental and our physical energies to concentrate and meditate will come to understand that more fully as well. Our hour is finished, and our Wednesday night class begins with chapter 17. And it starts at 7:30 on Wednesday.